I have actually two themes. I'm going to say related. They are maybe related, but maybe not so related. I would like to believe they're related. One is the importance, the usefulness, the possibility of enjoying meditation practice, enjoying a mindfulness practice. And the other comes out of two conversations I had today with two different Buddhist teachers. And both of them talked from different angles, different ways of looking at it. The ways in which Buddhist practitioners might... one person used the word deny, use their practice as kind of deny or avoid, be in denial about certain parts of their experience. And the other talked about how people can use Buddhist practice to become very conscious of things. But he talked about how if you bring light on something, the light often creates a shadow, kind of Jungian idea. And so the stronger the light, the more the greater the shadow. And so Buddhist practice also, sometimes doesn't help a lot with revealing certain aspects of our experience. And he mentioned two things in particular he thought Buddhists were not very good at bringing awareness to or waking up to. So the blind spots of practice is one side of one theme, and the other side, the other theme is enjoying one's practice. And I think it's really, really good to enjoy oneself when one's meditating. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes there's physical pain or emotional pain, or sometimes, you know, there's just meditation's flat for whatever reasons. It goes up and down. And you can't will to have your meditation a certain way. But you can certainly dispose yourself or lean yourself in certain directions and make it possible to enjoy yourself more often than not. If it never occurred to you, it never occurred to a person to enjoy meditation, just being told that you should enjoy it might just open up a whole area of meditation practice that was inaccessible to you. You might have some joy, have some enjoyment happening in the practice, but you ignore it. I know some people think that enjoyment is not supposed to be part of Buddhist life. And so you should, you know, not pay attention to that. You should ignore that. And if it bubbles up, if it kind of pushes up, you know, into awareness, then you kind of try to push it back down. I'm a Buddhist today, so don't. And there is that kind of approach sometimes. People are kind of grim about their practice, and there's not much happiness in it. And I know sometimes I've been very serious about practice, and sometimes the seriousness of practice, you know, makes me kind of avoid the lightness of practice or the sense of well-being that come with practice. I think it's very helpful to look for a sense of well-being as one is meditating, to be able to learn to recognize a sense of well-being within ourselves as we're sitting and practicing or in mindfulness. And it might at first, or it might sometimes be just a very mild sense of well-being. But the recognition of well-being helps to develop it, helps to strengthen it. There's a teaching in Buddhism that unhealthy states of heart or states of mind, unhealthy trains of thought, tend to thrive when they occur unawaringly, without any awareness. And healthy states of mind or healthy trains of thought tend to be developed, be encouraged as we bring awareness to it. So the lack of awareness, the darkness, tends to help proliferate things which are not very healthy for us. And awareness tends to develop things which are healthy for us. And a sense of well-being is one of the things that I found grows with attention to it and grows with awareness. So to tune into a sense of well-being. And it might be that a sense of well-being, and you sit down to meditate, might not be right in the forefront of, you know, right there, obviously there, if you sit down and start paying attention to breath. And I've sat down to pay attention to my breath or do walking meditation and had some agenda, some idea. I'm supposed to be a really good breath meditator, kind of ride my breath and be really focused. Just kind of, that's going to be the solution for me, is just being concentrated on my breath. And I have this one thing I'm going to pay attention to. And then sometimes it works out okay, and sometimes it doesn't. But what it does, that kind of one-pointed kind of attention sometimes causes me to ignore a sense of well-being or pleasure or enjoyment that might be there. And I found that even at times when I'm not feeling very well, there can still be a little bit of sense of well-being in some part of my body, part of who I am. And so to learn to recognize and look for a sense of well-being can be part of mindfulness practice. Sometimes when people do mindfulness practice, there's the idea that it's supposed to be choiceless. You're not supposed to have any agenda. You're not supposed to be looking for something or wanting anything to happen. But to some degree, that's a very wise teaching. But it's a little bit of an advanced teaching. It's fine to spend some time initially and various times in practice to look to try to develop a sense of well-being, recognize it. And once you've recognized a sense of well-being or enjoyment or pleasure or something that might be there, then it's a lot easier, I find, to focus on the breath. It's a lot easier to be mindful with that as a background or the foundation. And it's possible to have a lot of enjoyment in doing meditation practice. And different people will find enjoyment for different reasons. Some people find enjoyment because it can be physically pleasurable. And there can be physical pleasure that comes with following the breath. Sometimes the breath can feel like you're getting massage. Or just a very pleasant sensation kind of ripple out from the sensations of breathing. Some people find it's just very pleasant because it's peaceful. And it's enjoyable just to be quiet. You know, you're not being disturbed or not being very active and running after things and doing a lot of things. And so some people are overdoers in our culture. And to actually be in a situation where you don't have to do anything, just sit down and be quiet, can be very pleasurable, very enjoyable. Some people find enjoyment in practice from kind of the sense of investigation or the sense of exploration of awareness, kind of using their awareness. Sometimes I actually have kind of a playfulness with my awareness that sometimes is very helpful. It gets me very attentive, very much in the present moment, to be playful. One of the silly ways that I've been playful, I'm not going to say it's wise or even useful, but this is one of the things I've done, is use my awareness like I was playing maybe like a pinball machine or like the arcades and you're shooting something, you know. So, oh, there's something. Bah, there's something. There's something. And, it's kind of fun sometimes. And sometimes, you know, and you can certainly do it in a way that's not fun. But, you know, I've done that kind of playfully, kind of just, you can have fun with awareness. You can kind of take awareness and kind of let it move through your bodies in different ways and explore different parts of your body. What's it like to bring attention to this now and that and look at this now? And what's it like to kind of ride on this kind of surface of all the sounds that come around? What's it like to have awareness, kind of feeling like it's surfing or riding on the currents of sounds happening all around you? What's that like? You know, some people come up with interesting ideas. What's it like to bring awareness and do that with awareness? I know one friend of mine who imagined awareness was like a great soaring eagle, a bird. And all the things that happened were like the updrafts. And she was going to soar on the updrafts of her experience, updrafts of her breath going up and down. And kind of a playful way of being with the practice. Overdone, it gives the wrong idea of what mindfulness practice is. But as a way of helping us get concentrated and helping us get mindful and be present, I think it's very helpful to have a sense of enjoyment, a sense of playfulness, a sense of sometimes even a pleasure in the practice itself. And if you're doing mindfulness meditation for a long time and you don't feel pleasure, you don't feel enjoyment or sense of well-being from it, then it's useful to come and talk to a teacher about it and explore what's going on and see what can you do to bring more enjoyment to the practice. One of the things that I find that brings enjoyment, and actually I feel is a very important part of practice, is to bring awareness to the places in my experience which are not pleasant. If I feel tension, or if I feel stress, or if I feel some anxiety about something, there's an art, there's a way of bringing attention or mindfulness that hold it in awareness that interface of awareness and the tension or the stress or the whatever, I find to be there's a kind of pleasure or satisfaction from that bringing awareness and holding it there. Physically, in my body, if there's some tension, physical tension in my muscles and my body, then I find it enjoyable to kind of massage or bring attention to that tension in my body. Sometimes if it's in my torso, then I'll bring awareness to, as the torso is moving with the breath, it expands and contracts, shoulders go up and down a little bit. It's kind of like a massage. And so I kind of let that movement of the body kind of really ripple through, or really kind of, I really feel what the movement does to that part of my body which is tense. Like shoulders, for example, right? It's a common place to be tense for some people. And I have some tensions there sometimes. And so I feel it there. And then my shoulders will move and expand and contract, lift up and down or sideways a little bit as I breathe. And as I breathe, I feel the texture or the movement or the change in the sensations of tension in my muscles. And I find that to be actually enjoyable to do, even though I'm paying attention to something which is unpleasant in and of itself. So I do the same thing sometimes with emotional discomfort. It is somehow that bringing awareness to it, and there's an art of bringing awareness to that, which actually has a sense of satisfaction to it and enjoyment. One form of satisfaction is that of there's a rightness to it. The feeling of this is right, even though I'm feeling uncomfortable, and this is what's happening for me, emotional discomfort or whatever. Given that this is what's going on for me, there's something that feels very right about being honest about it. And not only being honest about its presence, but actually feeling it and attending to it at the same time. And I find a kind of sense of well-being and satisfaction from having the ability to bring mindfulness to that part of my life which is uncomfortable. So there's enjoyment from that also that comes. Part of the instructions, you know, to enjoy your practice is to be on the lookout for ways in which we are not enjoying the practice. And there's many, many ways in which people don't enjoy their mindfulness practice, their meditation practice, sometimes by trying too hard, sometimes by having very strong expectations of what's supposed to happening, and if it's not happening, then we feel disappointed. Sometimes by having judgments about what's right and wrong about ourselves or our meditation experience, whatever. And so we judge what's going on. We compare ourselves with other people. Other people are sitting stiller than I am, therefore I'm a terrible meditator. And so we have all these, you know, all kinds of ways which we don't enjoy ourselves in meditation. It's very, very, very important in mindfulness practice to monitor oneself and to notice if there's no enjoyment or sense of well-being in the practice, to then be honest, but why is that? Why is that the case? And then not be patient, not be tolerant, not be unconscious or unattending to the causes and conditions for the lack of enjoyment, the lack of what's going on. So then the other theme, that of kind of the denial or the unconsciousness of Buddhists. Sometimes there's a tendency of people who meditate, if they're starting to get proficient with their meditation, a little bit good at meditating, getting concentrated, to use that as a way of ignoring something else. So if you want to, you know, if you really get absorbed in your breath, or if you get very concentrated on your whatever your meditation subject is, then the more concentrated you are, the less you're aware of the things around you, things to, on the side of it. I used to have sometimes physical pain in my legs when I sat. And one of my strategies of dealing with that was trying to get really concentrated on my breath. And I knew if I got really concentrated on breathing, get absorbed in the breath, I would lift myself out of the pain. So I would just kind of leave, it wasn't exactly leave my body, but it was kind of like the concentrated state would just kind of, there simply wouldn't be any physical pain there. Partly because I was so absorbed in the breath that there wasn't any space for paying attention to anything else. And sometimes I was able to do that, and sometimes I couldn't. And then I'd be more miserable. But sometimes, you know, that wasn't very beneficial for me to use that kind of avoidance mechanism. But there's many things. If people feel emotional distress, some people will use meditation as a way of trying to avoid that emotional distress. Pull away from it. I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm going to try to get concentrated so I don't have to look at this. Some meditation practices, techniques, are more lend itself more to avoiding parts of our life than others. So, for example, when a person has a very narrow focus of attention in meditation, then that tends to more easily lead to avoidance than if the focus of attention is very broad. So, what I mean, for example, if a person is following the breath and they're following the breath at the nostrils, there's a very common Buddhist practice to follow at the tip of the nose. It's a very, very effective and can be very effective and very useful place to pay attention to the breath. But it's a very narrow part of our life, this part. And not very much of our life happens at the nostrils. And partly that's why it's maybe easier for some people to get concentrated. There's less to pay attention to, less distractions, less, you know, of our life there, so we can get more concentrated for some people. But it tends to be sometimes at the expense of not having a very strong foundation, broad foundation of kind of working through stuff or purification or settling stuff or being honest about what's really going on. So, but if you pay attention to the breath in the torso, in the chest or in your belly, much more of our life happens here. There's a lot that goes on in the area of our heart. There's a lot that goes on in our belly and our torso and in general. And so if you're paying attention to the breath in those places, you tend then also become aware of the emotions, the feelings, the responses, the life that goes on in this part of our body, the muscles that happen, how they change, the heart, the stomach, whatever. And so as you begin breathing here in this part of your body, you're more likely then to begin working through or to relax or soften these places. And as you soften physically, you're also then softening the emotional holding that might be there. So Buddhists often talk about, traditionally talk about practice as being a purification process. And so we're trying to kind of purify ourselves or cleanse ourselves of the ways in which we're tense or holding or tight or attached or, you know, stuff that's kind of held. And so by breathing with the body and beginning to kind of like using the breath as a massage to loosen up the kind of constrictions and tightness that connected to the breathing or in the torso, that purification process begins to happen. And as it happens, it tends to create a bigger, better foundation, like a broad foundation for going really deep in practice. If you follow a meditation that's very, very precise and very narrow focus, people sometimes can get very, very concentrated. But occasionally what happens is that they don't have a solid base. It's like then they have this really narrow pole that stands straight up. And if you try to take a narrow pole, you know, and stick it up like this, pretty quickly, and it's going to fall over pretty easily, right? But if you have a triangle, pyramid doesn't fall over very easily, right? So there's a very important principle of Buddhist practice where you're trying to kind of, in a sense, construct a pyramid in your practice where you have a very solid base to begin with. And my suggestion is that that solid base at the foundation, and all along as you go up and build that pyramid, well-being is one of the key aspects of it. A sense of well-being, a sense of happiness, a sense of enjoyment. Another aspect of denial or avoidance or blind spots for Buddhists is a little bit psychological and also cultural, as you know, as a Buddhist culture. But there tends to be a phenomena of having certain ideals, and then in having those ideals, somehow ignoring or avoiding or pretending they're not there, those things which don't look like the ideal. So, for example, a common shadow aspect of Buddhist culture that I've seen in the different places I've been is different Buddhist cultures I've been in often is anger. Buddhists like being kind, and they like being kind of, you know, not too caught up in their reactivity. And being angry is often seen as being the opposite of being kind, and it's often seen as being kind of caught in your reactivity. So good Buddhists don't necessarily want to, you know, flaunt that. There are places in society where it's fine to flaunt your anger, and so, you know, people do it, and they develop real abilities. You know, you get reinforced and get help in doing it, and it's really great. But you don't really get a lot of support in Buddhist circles, you know, in, you know, working up your anger and helping you, you know, get reinforced. And so the tendency in Buddhist circles is people don't show their anger that quickly. They kind of keep it from fellow Buddhists. And then if they do a little bit, then the idea is, oh, you're not supposed to be angry. And then it kind of becomes kind of a cycle where as a culture, we tend to kind of be less and less validating of anger or less willing to show it. Or conflict is another one. Buddhists are not supposed to be in conflict, right? They're supposed to get along peacefully. And so if we feel some conflict, we kind of just don't talk about it so much, or we ignore it, we pretend it's not there, or whatever. And because we, you know, it's not so validated to be in conflict. And so these cultural aspects, what I call cultural shadows that exist. And it's not unique to Buddhism. My theory is that every culture has a shadow. And so as soon as you have a group of Buddhists together, they create a shadow, or they create aspects, you know, ideal and what they don't want to look at and things like that. And it can be big, you know, greater and lesser degrees how much it's done. But Buddhists have that. The hope is that Buddhist practice is the cure for the Buddhist culture. That the mindfulness practice, the awareness practice, is helping to help us to be honest about the things that otherwise, in other circumstances, we might be wanting to ignore. And so our lack of well-being, our sense of discomfort, our unhappiness, or the tension in our body is something that is very important to stop for and be very honest about and see what we can learn from, what we can learn from that. I think it's very hard to stay unconscious or stay denying if we're in our body, if we're paying careful attention to what's going on, physically, emotionally, and all that. So if we can quiet ourselves enough or be still enough or be attentive enough, we'll notice in a certain situation, oh, I'm getting kind of hot here. Oh, I'm feeling a little kind of resistance here from letting people see what's really going on for me. And that sense of resistance or holding back then is a clue to telling you what's going on. And then hopefully, in doing the practice, we don't stay in denial. We don't stay in avoidance. We don't stay in ignoring that which doesn't match the ideal. But rather, the function of the practice is to reveal it all. Now, one of the things my friend said today about how you see Buddhists are kind of are unconscious, areas they're unconscious about, was interesting. I don't know if it's true, but it was kind of interesting what he pointed to. One was the interrelational dimension of how people relate to each other. And I said, well, that's not right. I mean, Buddhists put a lot of emphasis on ethics and be mindful in speech and generosity and kindness and loving kindness. They're all kind of interrelational, part of our interrelational world, how we relate to each other. And he suggested, well, yeah, but it tends to be one direction. It tends, for the most part, to be, you know, I'm going to be kind towards you, I'm going to be generous, I'm going to be ethical. It tends to be, you know, somehow generated from inside of us, how we relate to others. But what he was talking about is something that occurs in the interaction between people, the give and take, the way we mirror each other, the way that we unconsciously kind of adjust ourselves to how other people are. And he said Buddhists aren't so good at seeing the kind of unconscious, subconscious, or kind of ways in which we adjust and modify ourselves based on who we're talking to, who we're in relationship with. And, you know, we do a lot. I mean, most of us know it. I mean, I was surprised at some point in my life when I realized I was somewhat different depending which friends I was hanging out with. It was, you know, and I remember when I was young, I actually didn't want some friends to see how I was with other friends because I was a different guild. And then when I realized that there was a different guild depending which language I spoke, because I grew up speaking different languages, and it actually was I learned a different, you know, it's kind of like you learn a personality by the culture you grew up in. And so, and the language is very much part of that. And so by learning a different language, you learn a different culture, you learn a different personality, because personality is not a fixed thing. It's something that partly also gets co-created by the culture around you. And so we tend to, you know, adapt ourselves to the situation we find ourselves in, the people we find ourselves in. And so the suggestion of my friend is that Buddhists are not so good at looking at that part of the relationship, is how we adapt, how we adjust ourselves subconsciously, unconsciously, to who we encounter, who we meet. And then the other thing he said that he thought Buddhists were not so conscious of was, the relational stuff, and then what he called the unconscious. And he said the two are closely related. So that's a huge topic, but I thought I would just share that with you, and hopefully that's useful and interesting and enjoyable to hear. And if it's not, then I apologize. So now it's your turn for comments or questions. Yes?
This is a personal question. What do you get angry at?
What do I get angry at?
Yeah.
What do I get angry at?
Or maybe that's not the right question. When do you feel angry?
What do I get angry at? When do I get angry?
Or do you?
Oh, sure, I get angry. I've gotten the angriest in in the last 15 years in relationship to having children. Sometimes it was just kind of, it wasn't really, at least I wasn't consciously aware of it being directed towards anyone. I was just so frustrated at how things were going. And that things were not going the way I wanted them to go. So frustration is, you know, closely connected to anger. I mean, it happened, you know, just like it happened 2 hours ago. A little bit more than 2 hours ago, I had it towards my son. And this behavior, I mean, and then I didn't know, is this behavior something that I tolerate? Or is this behavior which I had to stop in some way? And it's not always so clear. You don't want to, you know, create some complex in these kids, you know, saying, you can't do that. You know, just because they're acting silly, you know, every time they're silly, you know, it's whatever. And so I what do I do here? I was frustrated. I was annoyed. And I didn't know whether I should, you know, I don't think it's always useful to tell a child you're annoyed. When mostly it's because, you know, it's nothing to do with him, the issues. And so, but then we got involved in a woodworking project. And it turned out that what really helped him was he just started sanding. I couldn't believe. He started sanding and sanding his pieces of wood. I just cut these pieces of block into blocks, right? He started sanding. And he was getting, I don't know if he was doing intentionally, I don't know what he was doing, but the effect was that it calmed him down. But until he got calm, I was like, this is, you know. I think he's a different species. I also got him to eat. I said, I'll do woodworking with you if you eat first. And he said, okay. Anyway, so it happens. And one of the great values for me of having children has been that there are aspects of my things that I'm attached to, things that I didn't really know I had until the limitations that come with parenting hit me over the head. Yes?
The comment and the personal perspective. The comment is that you spoke before on, is it Savannah, beauty?
Oh, some time ago, yeah.
And that as the word that describes a healthy heart mind.
Yes.
And so that the possibility of enjoyment, meditation is the discovery of beauty.
Beautiful, yeah. I think there's a lot of causes for happiness or enjoyment in meditation, but that's very much one of them. And it's a very, it can be a very powerful one. At least for me, it's been very powerful. And it kind of sometimes comes as a surprise, or especially in early years of practice, when there's a very strong sense of beauty or purity. Purity and beauty, I feel, is, in meditation, are closely connected. And when there's a tremendous sense of purity that somehow kind of permeates the heart, the body, the mind, it's like one of the best things, most enjoyable things I know.
The personal question is, how does one discover what you don't know? You don't know what you don't know. And I'm sometimes recently profoundly not at function outside of things. But to the source of that, again, when I said, it's so soothing, the source of whether that is part of the avoidance or part of the purification.
So you hear the question. It's a very interesting question. So how do you... So he said he has some anxiety in his life, but when he sits and meditates, it soothes out. He gets calm or settled. And so it disappears, that anxiety, but he hasn't resolved or dealt with it. It's just kind of gone away. And then I guess after meditation, it comes back. And sometimes that can happen. And then the bigger question earlier was how do you know, how do you understand or know that which you don't know? How do you discover that? That which you're subconscious of or unconscious of. And so the first part about anxiety, sometimes if something persists over and over and over again, doesn't go, you know, just a regular pattern of anger or anxiety or something that doesn't seem very healthy to have over and over again, and you sit and meditate and it goes away, but then, you haven't really dealt with it, it just goes away, and then you come back, comes back again, and meditate, it calms down. Or if you're really good at letting go of it, you can let go of your anger really easily, but then, 5 minutes later, it's back, and you let go of it again, and it comes back right away. Then probably a person should stop doing those things. Stop letting go. Or stop meditating in such a way that meditation makes you calm. And so there's a term, I think, in psychoanalysis called hovering. Is that a psychoanalytic term? Hovering? To hover? It's something I learned because at one point, a therapist taught me, pointed out to me that I was really good at letting go of my anger, but I hadn't understood it. And so she taught me to hover with the anger, so not let go of it right away, but let it just stay there for a while so that I could investigate it and explore it and really get to know it in a way that I hadn't, because I'd been so good at getting concentrated and letting go of it. So you might want to try not to get concentrated when you sit. And you might still sit, but you might sit with your eyes open, you might sit in such a way, don't pay attention to your breath. You might just bring your attention directly into the anxiety, and sometimes that can help. If bringing it directly into the anxiety makes it go away, then you might want to hover at the edges of the anxiety or do some kind of different kind of exploration. There's a lot of experimentation that can be done different ways for your question. I tend to have a strong bias towards going through the body, so going into the physical aspect of the anxiety as a route to really understand it and come to terms with it. The body, I kind of almost like to say the body is the royal road to the unconscious. It's so effective. But how do you know what you don't know? The body can be a great help. Mindfulness can be a great help. Getting concentrated and calm and still can be a great help. Learning a little bit about how the mind works, so you can learn to look in the areas that normally you would not pay attention to, can be helpful. So sometimes study can help because I didn't know that part of my mind. I think I'll look there. Another thing, aspect, way that's really helpful is to ask for or just pay attention to feedback from others. And sometimes other people can see things. Other people can help you see things that you can't see for yourself. And so there's many, from talking to a friend to noticing how the checkout clerk at Safeway raises her eyebrows when you show up. Oh, that's interesting. Why is that? I think there's feedback here. What is it about me and how I am? Sometimes it's asking for feedback from friends. Sometimes it's therapy. Getting feedback there, or being in a relationship there. Sometimes it's in the relationship to other people that we get feedback. And maybe that points to what my friend said, that Buddhists are not so good at the interrelational aspect. In this chaplaincy training program that I'm helping to teach, one of the exercises we did there was to have people walk into the room as if they're walking into a hospital room to be hospital chaplain, and then people say, point out, people kind of the audience, people watching the person walking in, and pointing out what they see as the person walks in. And there's a wide range of things that people see. Some of it which is projection, and some of it is not projection. It's just, what I see is a really big big men. And when I see really big men, you know, I get intimidated because I'm 4'5". And the big person had no clue that this big body was intimidating. Or someone else, you know. So we carry ourselves certain ways that sometimes we have no clue how what impact we have on others. And so sometimes that we learn that by asking for feedback. Can you tell me something about myself that maybe I don't see yet? How is it people experience me when I walk into the room? And we get experience in different ways in different settings. If, you know, it's one thing to walk in, anyway, different kinds of people. You know, if we're, for those of us who are white or white males, we get perceived differently by different people. Different ethnicities will experience us differently in our culture. And for many years when I was younger, I had no clue that people were seeing me any different than who I actually was. I'm just Gil, you know, unitary single kind of thing. And everybody sees me exactly how I am. And so but people see through their own filters. And so there's this wonderful interplay between how we understand ourselves and how other people understand us. And that it's a porous dynamic. They kind of affect each other. So anyway, getting feedback is one way. A great way is, you know, a great person to get feedback is spouses and children. It's said that if you really want to check out a Zen master, you're supposed to check out teachers. It's supposed to be really important. If you want to study with somebody, you're supposed to check them out for a long time and see, you know, if they're really okay. You're not supposed to settle on a teacher really fast. You're supposed to check them out for a long time. And it said in kind of, you know, not in any text, but it said kind of in the alleys of Buddhism, back alleys, that if you really want to check out a teacher, you go talk to their children and find out, you know, what the children think, and then you find out something that you know. No. Anyway, but don't ask my son until he's a bit older. I think he's too young for that. Last one, then we should stop, yeah.
Could you talk some more about mirroring with someone to enhance communication quicker, and about what you were saying about your different deal with different people? Can you talk about that more?
Well, that's a big topic. But the... I think that being different people in different settings is healthy. It's normal. And it can be unhealthy if we're kind of being insincere in doing it and trying to put up a front and, you know, and playing games. But I think it's completely healthy and normal. In every different situation we find ourselves in, we change. We're changed by that situation. That who we are is not some solid, fixed self, but it's something that exists in relationship to the environment. And we're different in relationship to the same person, same friend, on different days. You know, it's kind of it's always malleable and moving and changing. In Zen world, they say that you can never find out who you are in some way that you know forever. This is who I am. But rather, you're constantly rediscovering yourself in every interaction. And you don't know who you are until you interact. If you sit, you know, in your own privacy of your own room and, you know, I mean, and don't interact, then you won't know who you are. But you discover who you are in activity, kind of what they say. It's a little bit simplistic, but... and then mirroring is a little bit difficult. It's best to talk about it first and have permission. But, you know, if you want to do it explicitly and talk about it, you know, what is it that you see here? You know, if when we meet, what are you seeing here? You ask them. Ask them to give feedback and tell you. But the mirroring happens anyway. I mean, I'm sitting here talking to you now, and you're nodding your head. And I'm getting something back. I'm getting some kind of interest. You're mirroring that what I'm saying looks like maybe interesting for you. And that's helpful for me, and I'm going to keep going. If you had different facial expression, if you were going like this, you know, what have I said, you know? I'd mirror. So we get a lot of feedback from people around us, and we pay attention to those cues. We learn a lot of what's going on. And we do that kind of often subconsciously anyway. And then we do it sometimes in unhealthy ways. And I haven't noticed that I do that so much anymore. But I remember many years ago, at some point, when I used to teach in Palo Alto, that if there was one person in the room of 100 people who was sitting there in the back going, you know, I was focusing on that person while I spoke. That was the mirroring I was focusing on. Everyone else is, you know, shining and radiant. This is the most brilliant thing that's ever been said in Buddhism, you know. And I wouldn't, you know, but that one person. And then I found out later the person, you know, had indigestion. And so, you know, I was allowing myself to be mirrored in something, you know. So we often do it anyway. So sometimes the agenda, the way which we select, what we select out of the environment, is has to do with our own, sometimes our own fears, our own agendas, our own things. And then to learn how to have, you know, healthy mirroring and really kind of take it all in is an art in itself. So I don't know if that was helpful. So, thank you. I hope this is okay, this talk today. And if it helps you enjoy your practice a little bit, I'd be very happy.